Our presentation today is Restringing the Bead by Michael Esalen. It relates to our fourth principle of free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Popular guest speaker and UCLA oncology chaplain, Michael Esalen, is visiting our congregation today. Using a few of the stories of the patients he has served, as well as some deeply personal ones of his own, Michael will explore our relationship to the narrative of our own lives and how we use those stories in an attempt to make spiritual sense of our lives. He's going to start by leading the meditation.
In the spirit of prayer and contemplation, I invite us to get comfortable in our seats and close our eyes and take a few nice deep breaths together. As we quiet our minds, we go within and follow the empty breath. We let go of the concerns of the day, the replaying of the week behind us, and the anticipation of the week ahead. As we allow ourselves to be fully present in this moment, we give ourselves the gift of stillness here and now, together, sitting in community, virtually, as close as beads on a necklace. As we move into that stillness, I invite us to contemplate the words of the poet David White. Sometimes everything has to be inscribed across the heavens so you can find the one line already written inside you. Good morning. Many years ago, I had the great good fortune to hear the South African playwright Athol Fugard give a lecture on the theater, on its very origins, its essence. In his view, the theater began when the first cave dwellers emerged from their caves, sat around the fire, and somebody said, "Hey, listen, this is what happened to me." Our stories, it would seem, can shape us. They can sustain us. They can explain us to ourselves and each other, and they most certainly offer us a pathway to connect to one another, to our families, to the larger circle of life. I had a friend, Polly, who was a brilliant woman, a professor of world cultures at UCLA, and she taught me about the Luba people of Central Africa, about whom she was an expert. The Luba would document their stories through intricate beadwork, creating these elaborate artifacts known as lukasas, or sometimes stringing beads in an intentional way into a necklace. Now, the reading of the beads, the deciphering of their code, the telling of the stories depended upon who had the standing to do so, who had the authority to wear the necklace or to even restring the beads. And the meaning of those stories was fluid, changeable over time, dependent not only upon the arrangement of the beads and who's doing the telling, but the time and place in which the story is told. Not so different, really, from the way we tell and recount our own stories, using the language of words, changeable over time, depending upon who's doing the telling. Still, I'm struck by the artistry of this, the creativity in creating an object in a way that a word can never really be. While our stories may sustain us, they might also haunt us. But either way, they also provide the opportunity, maybe even the invitation, to make some spiritual sense of our lives. How do our stories intersect with our beliefs, our understanding about any kind of larger truth or understanding? Does God exist? How does prayer work? Does life go on after this one? Even though the clarity that that intersection might provide might be as fleeting and changeable as the arrangement of beads on a necklace. Sometimes our stories might just serve as a kind of signpost to see us through a particularly challenging time. Norma is in her 70s and recently diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And she told me, "Michael, I get a lot of strength from watching the movie of my own life play in my head." She drew her strength from the very challenges she herself had faced. By slight contrast, many years ago, I worked for a hospice and I had a patient, Harold, who was in his mid-80s and had suffered a quite debilitating stroke. Every week I visited Harold, every week it was the same thing. He'd recount the same five or six stories, the same five or six beads on his necklace, over and over again in rapid fire succession in this closed loop kind of tape, reliving each moment as he told it. And then I met the most beautiful woman in the world, and we fell in love and we got married and we were so happy. And then she got sick and she died, and the Germans, they were shooting at me and they shot my buddy right in front of my face. And so it went for an hour or forever long, I would sit there. If I tried to interrupt Harold's loop and ask him a question, say, Harold, how did you meet your wife anyway? He got a little irritated, as if awakened from a trance. What was that? He'd answer me, but he would go right back to the comfort of his chant. 80 plus years of life had all been refined and distilled down to five or six stories, five or six beads on his necklace. Who would we be without our stories? As one who loves to collect objects from my travels as a way of remembering them, I love this idea of imbuing an object with meaning. The object stays the same, but the meaning might change and evolve over time. Sometimes, though, it can be tempting to confuse the object with the meaning itself. Lourdes was razor thin, wheelchair bound, in her 70s, rectal cancer, tenderly cared for by her son, Enrique. But on this particular day in the infusion clinic, she was very distressed and tearful. She told me the story of how decades earlier, when she left her native Puerto Rico, that her mother had given her a few precious pieces of jewelry to remember her by. Now, Lourdes was also a bit of a pack rat. She kept all of her belongings in little bags and baggies strewn on the floor, surrounding the recliner where she spent most of her waking hours. Earlier that week, in an attempt to tidy up, Enrique inadvertently threw out the baggie with the jewelry in it. Lourdes was beside herself with grief and anger. Michael, I'm so upset. I haven't been able to sleep all week. I haven't been able to eat. And the nurse just told me I lost 5 pounds. Now, if you'd seen her, you'd see she did not have 5 pounds to lose. And I'm so angry at Enrique. Why is he such a control freak? Why was he so careless? I invited Lourdes to gently take a dip into the spiritual waters of forgiveness, which was not a good call on my part, I must admit. So then I invited a reflection on what was the real gift her mother gave her. Was it really just a few pieces of jewelry, or was it her undying love and affection as symbolized by the jewelry? And that's a gift that can't be lost, misplaced, or thrown away. In a similar kind of way, it seemed Lourdes had the gift of precious little time left on the planet. Would she spend the gift of that time enjoying the love of her son, Enrique, or would she spend it stewing in her own anger? She just might. That would be her choice to make. I sometimes think the very last choice we have is the choice to assign meaning to our stories. And who has the authority to tell our own stories, to own them, if you will? Do we alone own them, or do we sometimes give that power away to the opinion and interpretation of others? I imagine most of us have those people in our lives who would be all too happy at any given moment to tell us exactly what sense we should make of our lives, what it all means, and what we should do about it. What about giving away our power to the values of the larger culture? As one who looks almost daily at the theme of success in life, both in my own life and certainly in the lives of the patients I walk beside, I will tell you that is one challenging bead to interpret unencumbered by the values of the larger culture we've all been force-fed about just what success looks like. What about ideas about health? Healing, wellness, are we limited to the images we see on magazine covers or ideas we hear from the medical establishment? Do you suppose it's possible to inhabit a dying, cancer-ridden body and still claim a sense of wellness, even healing? I believe so because I've seen it. But what about the reverse? Anna, a beautiful young woman, 30 years old, cured of Hodgkin's lymphoma, given the all clear by her doctor, go live your life, be well. But she was paralyzed, immobilized with fear and grief, grieving so terribly the lost innocence of a limitless future. She now knew in no uncertain terms that any good thing could be snatched away in the blink of an eye. What's more, she felt like damaged goods. No man will ever love me now. Well, her interpretation of that cancer bead would be very different from how her oncologist would interpret that very same bead. From what I observe, attaching ourselves to any particular meaning and seeing it as fixed and unchanging can really trip us up. It can intensify our suffering. I would suggest it can even stunt our spiritual growth, particularly when we add matters of faith to the mix. Doug was a great guy, mid-50s, passionate student of life, ardent spiritual explorer. You might describe his theology as pretty much New Age. For Doug, his core spiritual value was that of forgiveness. Everything came down to that for him. So when he was diagnosed with colon cancer, he was convinced that he got cancer because he'd never really forgiven his ex-wife, Tracy. They married when they were quite young, got divorced not long afterward, and though they'd been divorced for years, he was convinced that, as he confessed to me, I never really forgave her for her betrayal of me, and that's why I have cancer. So this became his spiritual quest. His life depended on it. So he read books and engaged in forgiveness exercises until the ultimate test. Michael, I'm going to call Tracy and tell her from that deepest place in my heart, I forgive you. Well, I guess Tracy didn't realize she'd been in trouble all these years. She had moved on and was living a different story. Still, she told him she was glad he had found some peace and she wished him well. But when his oncologist told him that his recent scans revealed that the cancer had gone into complete remission, well, he had all the proof he needed. It was because of forgiveness. He would tell anyone who would listen with the passion of a zealot. That is, until the cancer came back. Attaching ourselves to any particular meaning can really be a cruel business. In the early 90s, a big economic downturn had hit Los Angeles. I had a design business at the time and business fell off to zero. I needed to do something quick. So I took the CBEST test. I got an emergency teaching credential and I was hired to be a substitute teacher for Inglewood City Schools. Inglewood is a rather economically depressed, disadvantaged part of Los Angeles. This was a few weeks after the Rodney King uprisings in Los Angeles. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but soon enough, I discovered I did not have the constitution to face those schools every day. So on my off days, I volunteered at Project Angel Food in Los Angeles, delivering home-cooked meals to homebound people with AIDS. These were the peak years of the AIDS crisis. I also got involved with a fledgling volunteer AIDS hospice organization called Project Nightlight. But at the time, I felt like the loser of the world. No one could convince me otherwise. I assiduously avoided friends who might dare to call me and ask the unthinkable question, so what are you doing these days? What's more, I was convinced that God had dispensed all the components necessary to live a successful life to everyone else except me, firmly attached to that idea. And yet now, when I look back on that point in time, I see it as the pivot point that made this part of my life possible in this career of chaplaincy, though it took so many years to materialize. So am I to look back on that point in time now and call it a blessing? Hurting so badly that I wanted to die? Success and failure. It can be hard to tell sometimes which is which. A career or so before that, I was a professional dancer. In 1975, the Broadway musical, A Chorus Line, opened in New York City. I had never wanted anything so badly as to be a part of that production. And that's without even having seen it. That's just listening to the cast album over and over again in my teeny little apartment. Hey, those are my stories too. And I wanted to be a part of the telling. So in January 1976, Michael Bennett, the director, creator, choreographer of the piece, came out to LA to hold open auditions for an LA company and for national tours. The audition went on for 2 days. It was held at the old Aquarius Theater up on Sunset. Every dancer in Los Angeles was there. Everyone who thought they were a dancer was there. Though I was broke, I went out and bought new dance clothes just for the audition. Hey, this was my big chance, right? So I danced and I sang and I danced and I sang and I danced and I sang and I survived cut after cut after cut until toward the end of the second day, with maybe a dozen or so guys left on the stage, Michael Bennett said, okay, guys, I want you to line up. We're going to hand out scripts now and ask you to read for parts. Oh my God, this is it. I'm really going to make this happen. But just a minute, Michael and Jim, would you step forward, please? And with that, his co-choreographer, Bob Avian, jumped on the stage, came over to me and said, Michael, you sing and dance beautifully. I'm sorry, there's just not a part for you in the show. Thank you for coming. I couldn't breathe. It was as if I'd been kicked in the stomach. What, you didn't know that yesterday? I sucked up my tears. I scrambled to get my bag. I darted out the stage door into the alley where I lost it completely. Jim was a few feet in front of me in just as bad a shape. Just then, Charlene, who had been assisting Michael with the audition, came bolting out the stage door. Charlene, I had worked with her on a few TV specials. She comes racing out the door. She runs up to Jim a few feet in front of him, puts her arm around him, and I overhear her offer him another job right there on the spot for an upcoming TV special as a sort of consolation prize. Hey, Charlene, what about me? That moment is still so vivid. Fast forward 40 some years. Every Saturday, at least until the pandemic began, I took a dance class for former professional dancers of, shall we say, a certain age. I call it my old farts dance class. It is heaven on a stick. It is church. It connects me to this very deep, sacred part of myself. It's taught by Walter Painter, a choreographer who had given me my very first job in 1973 at the Sacramento Music Circus. He's assisted sometimes by his wife, Charlene, the one insane from the alley behind the Aquarius Theater in 1976. Now, I love Charlene to pieces. It's never occurred to me to tell her my memory of that day. I mean, what's the point? It's ancient history. Well, a few years ago, I got a terrible summer cold. I was up all night coughing so badly that I ruptured a vocal cord and I bled. I couldn't utter a sound, even if I wanted to. I think my husband, Scott, was kind of happy about that, actually. The cold got better, but I still had no voice. So that following Saturday, I went to dance class. And it just so happens that the national company of the Broadway revival of A Chorus Line was in town playing at the Pantages Theater. Now, some of the women in my class had been in that original production. One had even starred in the London production. So I got to class a little early. Some of the women are sitting, we're chatting, they're stretching. We're waiting for the ballet class to wrap it up in the studio before us. One of the women had gone to the Pantages the night before to see the show. So she's offering her review and critique. And then some of the others chime in. Oh, yeah, I remember when Michael Bennett called me and asked me to go to London with the show. And inside, I was just dying. And I couldn't talk. I could only listen. But it was as if a 40-year-old scab had been ripped right off. And all of that feeling of disappointment and dashed hopes and rejection and feeling less than, it all came flooding back as if it were yesterday. And just then, Charlene chimes in with, oh, yeah, I remember Michael called me and asked me to help him with the audition out here in L.A. And I told him, but Michael, I haven't even seen the show yet. And he said, but Charlene, the audition is the show. You're telling me. And in that moment, I so desperately wanted to say, Charlene, I was there. This is what I remember that day. Not because I needed to beat her up, but because I needed to claim my voice. I needed to claim my own story. But I couldn't talk. And I realized in an instant the perfection of that moment that I couldn't talk. Because you know what? It's my story. It's not anybody else's story. It's certainly not Charlene's story. It only matters to the degree I've assigned it meaning in my biography. And what if in the end, it doesn't mean anything at all? Sure, we might all use our stories to fascinate us or explain us to ourselves, or in this case, perhaps to anchor me into a deep sense of humility and compassion for those wounds that never really heal. But it would be my folly, I think, to attach myself to any particular meaning and seeing it as fixed. 9 years ago, I attended my 40th high school reunion, Wilson High School, Long Beach, California, class of 72. There aren't too many settings that are more ripe for the telling of stories in a high school reunion. And I have found if we keep our hearts and eyes open, any greater opportunity to reinterpret those formative stories. I've attended each reunion in 10-year increments, and each one seems to have its own flavor and personality. At the 10-year, it seemed like everybody wanted to show off and prove how successful they'd become. By this stage in life, most have been humbled by life and loss a bit. I always experience these as a compressed kind of time warp. I'm 14 and I'm 54 in the same moment, and I'm looking at everybody else through the same lens, looking right past all the wrinkles and the missing hair and the extra pounds, and I still see the handsome football player and the perky cheerleader and the bully and the one who made me laugh so hard in ninth grade English. Of course, everyone's memory doesn't serve them quite so well. I remember Randy Tischauer came up to me and said, "Yeah, Mike, I remember you always walking around in your Letterman's jacket." No, Randy, that would not have been me. Just then, Gary Wilson, who'd known me since third grade and knew me for the sissy that I was, chimed in with, "Oh, trust me on this, Randy, Mike never would have had a letter in anything." Gee, thanks, Gare. I was Mike then. The highlight of my evening came late. I was desperately looking for an empty table to sit down and just catch my breath from all of this overwhelming nostalgia. I wasn't seated but a few moments, and up walked Cheryl Young. "Hi, Mike, remember me?" I did remember Cheryl, although I'm certain we never had a class together, and I can't recall even having a single conversation with her, but I knew who she was. She had this short mop of curly hair and a wide silk scarf tied around her head. She had the sweetest smile, and she spoke with a kind of simplicity that made me think a little something else was going on. "Well, sure, I remember you, Cheryl. Have a seat. Tell me, how are you? How's life?" "Well, I've had some health problems," she said. "I had thyroid cancer, and earlier this year, I had an AVM. Do you know what that is?" I said, "Yes, I do. An arterial venous malformation. I used to work on the neuro floor." And with that, she pulled back her wig to reveal a very nasty scar across her skull. "I'm so sorry to hear that, Cheryl." I asked to hear a bit more about her story. And in this moment, I had this awakening that I have no need whatsoever to hear even one more word about her story. What's more, I felt no need to share even a bit about mine. What I felt was an urgent need to say, "Cheryl, I'm so glad you're here." Meaning at the reunion, of course, but more importantly, here in life. "Can I give you a hug?" "Oh, yes, please," she said. And when I hugged her, I had this overwhelming sensation that if there is such a place as heaven, this must be what it's like. Our stories just melt away. They just don't matter anymore. They are only this circuitous path that brought us up to this point in time where we can meet and we can hug and we can say, "I'm glad you're here." A year later, Glenn Johnston, a most beloved member of my family, my mom's partner for the previous 15 years, the love of her life that she waited 70 years to find, took his own life. Approaching 90 in failing health, resolute that he would not die in a hospital or a nursing home, and he would not be a burden to anyone else, he chose to write the ending to his own story. He left my mom a note on a corner scrap of yellow lined paper. 3 words. I love you. He left the note on the unfinished jigsaw puzzle he had been working on the night before. 90 years of life, and it all came down to 3 words on a corner scrap of yellow lined paper. That is one bead that we turn over and over again in our hand, trying to understand it, that love bead, the size of it, the weight of it, the facets of it, the color, the luminosity of it. It's so precious. We don't want to lose that one. We want more. We might spend our whole lives stringing and restringing our beads, and it might all come down to that one bead. Sure, our stories are powerful, and maybe they're everything, in fact, that make us who we are. And maybe they're just stories. As for myself, I'll just say, I'm glad you're here. So be it.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you. You raise an exquisite point. This career in chaplaincy, you know, was started about 20 years ago. I was a big left turn in my life from the design business to this. And when I applied to do an internship at UCLA, had to write exhaustively these essays of self-reflection. And one essay was, describe the 5 events in your life that have shaped you the most. Or something to that effect. And every one of those events was something profoundly painful. It wasn't graduating from college, falling in love for the first time, or seeing the Eiffel Tower for the first time. It was, right. It was the really hard stuff. And it made me come to a different relationship with those painful moments. And if we're going to use this metaphor of the beads, a raw gemstone needs to be tumbled violently to get to that place where it can be so luminescent and shine and beautiful. That diamond in the rough needs to tumble. And that if I can come to relationship with those things that challenge me so deeply, to say, okay, those are just polishing me, then maybe I don't have to have so much resistance to them. And the sweet things in life to me are the gravy. That's the icing on the cake after you've done the hard stuff. If somebody had to really work and save a lot and have a lifetime dream to be able to go to Paris for the first time, I would imagine that trip means a whole lot more than the one who was born into wealth and was parents worked there and they just flew back and forth. Yeah, well, okay, it's another city. So maybe the specialness comes out of having been tumbled.
So Michael is going to read our closing words for today.
Let's close our eyes right now and take a few nice deep breaths together. I invite you now to get an image in your mind of the particular string of beads that might represent your own life. What would yours look like? What shapes, what colors, what materials do you see? What textures? Would yours be simple or complex? And what would those primary beads for you be? No matter how those beads might get restrung, these are the ones that are front and center. May we honor those beads, enjoy them, cherish them. And when the time comes to let them go, to let them go, so be it.
Well, I want to thank you again, Michael, for coming. One of the joys of this virtual format is that we've been able to connect with you not once, but twice. So very grateful for that.
Me too.